this short resume and used it as a French speaking people in prophecy booklet in France, in French, to the French people. I don't know exactly all French, perhaps we have sent 20 or 30 or 40,000, I'm not sure, to all French speaking people. But what interests me is this: to this day, I don't remember having received more than 5, if that many, letters from French speaking people out of the 40,000 we have sent, claiming that they could find something wrong in history or what we said. In other words, the proofs given in this book were strong enough for the French people to accept and not to argue against it, except for 3 or 4, I guess, of the most, who of course objected to it, but they did not have any proofs against. I would like to stress one point before we go ahead, that I'm not going to speak for the French speaking per se, I'm going to speak for France primarily, because it's a vast subject, but I'll tell you in a moment why. I also would like to state that I am not, underline, not a historian. I'm not a scholar in that respect, but I do believe in the Bible. Therefore, I'm basing my knowledge, my research, with my wife's help, and she helped me a lot in Montreal, on what I discovered in the Bible from Mr. Armstrong's book and also from history books. I think that if you put all of this together, you'll be able to prove that French people indeed are the descendants of Reuben. What comes into your mind when you think of France? Most of us, of course, think of wine, winemaking, perfume, fashion. Some of us think of the Eiffel Tower. By the way, Eiffel Tower is only a monument built at an exposition or fair in Paris back in 1886. They had a Paris fair, so they tried to build an Eiffel Tower. Today, it has brought in more tourists in Paris than anything else. It has 900 feet high. But it is not my subject. Then we have, of course, when we think of France, we think of the Arc de Triomphe. Well, this too, it's beautiful. But you see, many people who go to Paris to even see the Arc de Triomphe, they don't even know what the Arc de Triomphe is. They don't realize this is Napoleon's monument to his own soldiers. It was built in 1806, and the French made of this arc, or the arch in English, the tomb or the grave of the unknown soldier after World War I. So this is the Arc de Triomphe, beautiful. It shows some of the French art, but the state is not my subject. You perhaps think of Paris, the springtime, is this what you think of France? You know, this is to be so interesting because people have ideas about France, yet they miss the point what really France is. It's beautiful to know the Eiffel Tower, the Arc de Triomphe, the Paris in the springtime, all these cafes and so forth. But you see, there is something more, and that's what I want to emphasize. Something which the Bible speaks about. Something which pertains to prophecy. France today is a major nation of major importance, both in history and in the world today. And this is the very part I would like to talk about today. There are just only a few cities here, just to give you an idea. And among them, of course, Paris, the largest city in France. I will speak about it in a moment. But France is, believe it or not, one of the largest countries in Europe. France has an atomic power since 1960, and today has 15 nuclear reactors. In 1968, it became the world's fourth nation to have the hydrogen bomb. In other words, you see, it's all fine to think about perfume and fashion and the Eiffel Tower and the wine, but we don't realize the power of France, which is prophesied, which we have sometimes overlooked. France today is a country where there's great literacy. Well, actually, I should say that French people today, speaking even compared to the United States, we have 99.9% literacy in France. It is also the world's fourth most important exporter of conventional arms and weapons, and except for Russia, the French army is the largest in Europe. Now, go a bit farther yet, as on this power that I showed you a moment ago, I spoke about. France today, together with Britain, of course, developed the great supersonic power of Concorde. But before that, perhaps you don't realize that the French is the world's fifth largest producer and second largest exporter of automobiles. Just to give you an idea. There's a lot of power, nuclear power, nuclear reactors in France. Here, this gives you an idea, world's arms merchants by billions of dollars. First US, then Soviet Union, France, then Great Britain, and what, Germany. Here's the French army, part of the list. Behind the Arc de Triomphe. Here's the famous Concorde. Of course, British and the French together designed the Concorde. It's the world's first successful supersonic airliner. There was only one thing with it. They spent too much time, they waited too long, and they produced too little, too few of them. So today, actually, even though Concorde is one of the prides of France, I think it's a fiasco, financial fiasco, because of the fact they've spent billions and billions of dollars, and with the price of the petroleum today, I don't think France will be able to benefit from it. Now here we have, from the very beginning of the 19th century until the World War II, France was the art capital of the world. Paris still recognized as the major center for connoisseurs, not only of art, but of music, architecture, cuisine. Here's a French Gothic and neoclassical architecture, which set the standard for the Western world for many centuries. Here's a very, very well-known Versailles, the magnificent Palace of Versailles, which ranks among the world's greatest tourist attractions. Versailles was the residence of kings, especially Louis the 14th. Here we have an aerial view of Paris. We can see then that France is a nation of significance today in the company of nations. And now let us look at the people who have had such great influence on history. Who are they? Where do they come from? Does the Bible give us any clues? This is what started my research. Mr. Armstrong, this book in English. I read it. My first reaction was to translate it into French, which I did. Then I saw that Mr. Armstrong proved in his book very clearly who the British people were, the Americans were, and specified very clearly the Western Europe. Now, I won't enter into details because of the fact you know very well, you have read the booklet. I'm not going to stress all the details in the book or the biblical background because we have it. But I would like to start from the book here, just a couple of items. Mr. Samson mentioned clearly that the physical promises were given to Israel, the 10 tribes, and the spiritual promises, the scepter, was given to Judah. I repeat, I want to stress the biblical background of Reuben. I won't have time for it. But we know that Reuben and his brothers sold Joseph. Actually, Reuben didn't quite sell him. He tried to save him, as you know. But he was the firstborn. He should have been able to be heard, resist his brothers, and not go along with them. In Genesis chapter 37, of course, you have the story about Reuben and the other brothers selling Joseph. So, because of this and other factors, Reuben was punished, not because of this primarily, but as I said, he was the first one who should have been more responsible. But now let's see if we can trace back the history of France and find out exactly where they come from and how we can perhaps link Reubenites with French people today. This, to me, is the most beautiful, interesting statement. History does not know the origin of any people. It's an author, very famous author. As we went to Montreal University, my wife and I, we discovered one major factor. Every book we actually read, every historian, they all began with this type of a statement, more or less. Someplace in the preface, someplace in the introduction. But from then on, they just made the statement, here is what happened. Strange, isn't it? They claim they don't know anything about the origin of any people, yet they make statements such as 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, and 10,000 years. So to me, this was the starting point. There's another one. As for the history of France, the earliest date that the authors of antiquity have given us is that of the founding of Marseille. That's one of the cities in the southern part of France. 120 years before the Battle of Salamis, which is 500 years before Christ. Now, this is a historical statement. Yet, every French historian, they overlook this part, which is very clearly states, that Reubenville is a great French historian, and he too, with the rest, they claim that the French people were in France, in Gaul, 10 or 15,000 BC. Now, if they don't know anything about it, if they claim that the first they have heard only 500 BC, how could they go back and start telling what happened 15,000 years before Christ? And here's what the Bible says about Reuben. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the first fruits of my strength, preeminent in pride, preeminent in power. That's why I showed you all these two slides in the beginning, because you saw the major power France is, militarily, economically, perhaps even art, language, certainly. Yet, France did enjoy preeminence, yet it is she did not keep her preeminence. See, God says, verse 4, unstable as water, you shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it, you went up to my couch. You know the story I want to emphasize, you know very well. This was therefore the punishment. Because of Reuben's attitude or action, Reuben was punished, and Reuben did not enjoy preeminence, even though he became, and still in many ways is, preeminent in many ways. Now, before the purchase of Louisiana, the French Empire was the most dominant empire. As the French language until World War I, and later until World War II, I should say, was the diplomatic language. Hence, this prophecy, the first part, has been fulfilled, is fulfilled, and even though France is not the preeminent country any longer, as verse 4 says, France has kept a knack of the preeminence to rate today among the four nations, powerful nations on the face of the earth. But then, what happened? If France lost the preeminence, to whom did it go? This is what we have to understand. Again, I will not go into Mr. Armstrong's book, but you know that Mr. Armstrong did make it clear. In 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 1, we read, "The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel," because he went to his father's couch and so forth, "therefore the birthright was given to whom? The sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that he is not enrolled in the genealogy. Therefore the birthright, Reuben had the preeminence, went from that time on to Joseph, or the descendants of Joseph." Of course, we know some of the reasons we saw. Yet, on the other hand, I don't think that French people today are more sinful than any other nations on the face of the earth as far as their background is concerned. As the Bible says, we all have gone backward and not forward. I think if you want to really see it, today you can see the Scandinavian countries, northern Europe, they are just as bad sexually or immoral, perhaps, than French. For that matter, even the USA has nothing to be proud of, or just about, because we have gone backward. But that's the way it started. So the question is, we know that Reuben, therefore, was punished. He was preeminent, but he lost preeminence toward the end for the benefit of Joseph. Now, can we really today identify 100% the tribes of Israel? This is the big question. When I read Mr. Armstrong's book, I was convinced, but I had to go one step further to prove that Reuben was also the ancestors of France. But before we go any further, I don't think you can convince anyone of anything unless that person has somewhat or something of God's Spirit in him. God says by faith we understand that the world was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was made of other things which do not appear. Now this, to me, is the foundation of faith. If we don't have this type of faith, no, I don't think we can prove anything. But if you really have faith in God, then with biblical evidence, with historical evidence, you can prove who the Israelites are and who the Reubenites are and so forth. So I put this slide because it explains that history alone, or for that matter any science, cannot and does not prove anything to a carnal-minded person. Faith plays a major role in recognizing the biblical history of creation, of biblical accounts. Please have this in mind as we continue the study. We don't have too much information on hand, but are there too many factors known? You know, let me just tell you something. Today, we have doubts, when I say we about mankind, as to who Shakespeare was. They cannot prove that Shakespeare existed. That's strange. There are about three or four books about Shakespeare showing that Shakespeare never existed. So if you cannot prove 200 years back that Shakespeare was or was not, how could you prove something which took place 3,000 or 4,000 years ago? But what is known, and based upon what God reveals, allows us to identify the descendants of Reuben as being the French-speaking countries. Let's now go into history. I repeat, I'm not a historian, far from it, but I believe in the Bible. As Mr. Armstrong proved in his book, I know that all of the Israelites went to the northern part of Europe and Great Britain and France after their captivity. Now they, as you know, around 700 BC, 720 BC, after their deportation, Israel, the Bible says, never returned home. This is in Samson's book and the Bible, you know it, I won't emphasize. So they didn't go back to Palestine. They settled in different regions in northwestern Europe. Now this is clearly shown in many ways. in the Psalms of books, or in history. For instance, in the book of Ezra, the Jewish writer, he says that the ten tribes of Israel, after their liberation, migrated to other countries. They did not return to their own land. 2 Ezra, chapter 13. Josephus says the same thing. The Bible clearly shows, which I brought up these slides here, in Jeremiah chapter 31, Isaiah chapter 49, Bible clearly shows that at the end time, you will find the tribes of Israel northwest of Jerusalem. Those are the things which you should know. I don't want to emphasize because of the fact Mr. Armstrong has made it very clear in his book. I repeat, I did not study, per se, in this study here, French-speaking countries, except as they come along with France, but only French people. The Bible speaks oftentimes of Reubenites, of Gadites, as you know. They were together most of the time. Secondly, history recognizes that actually all the people who came to France or Western Europe, even though they are different tribes, the same group of people, they came at different times, but they have much in common. Because Israel turned away from God, was taken to captivity, and as they left captivity, they were as pagan as any other nation, pagan nations. Hence, they lost their identity. It is hard for today to really know the difference between a pagan nation and Israel, which also became pagan. France, we know, as you see it here, this was before the Gauls entered France, was actually inhabited by other people who were pagans, who were other tribes, they were not Israelites. The names are, unfortunately, not the map I wanted, but I could not find the map I wanted. But France, prior to the invasion of the Gauls, or the Celts, this is a picture of it. Before the arrival of the Gauls in France, the country was inhabited by other people. Historians claim that these people were Ligurians, I repeat, and Iberians. You won't find the words here, unfortunately, it's Lugundus, that's not the same thing here. But Ligurians and Iberians were the first inhabitants of this country. This is historic history. Now, all kinds of dates are given for the arrival date of these people. But as you know, a moment ago you heard that first thing they knew was only 600 B.C. Therefore, all this is only, let's say, hypothetical. The Ligurians came from Sicily. There are traces of the Ligurians in the southern part of France. Ligurians are more or less Greek descendants. And today, any Frenchman will tell you that most southern part of France is under Greek influence. They even look more like Greek. They have a different accent from the north. Not that, of course, Ligurians are still there, but they have left some marks. So the southern part was Ligurians. And the western part, and west and south of Spain, were the Iberians. Again, I repeat, the Iberians and Ligurians left very little influence on France. They are not the ancestors of French. Now, this is historical evidence. Any French historian will tell you that Iberians and Ligurians were not the ancestors of France. They will all say that the Gauls or the Celts or the Celtic people were the actual ancestors of France. That's something to remember. That's awfully important. Now, as we start our migration, I wanted to see on the right side, due to the right side, Scythia. Then we have Sumerians, also in practice Scythia. On the left side, you have Gallia, and northern part of Italy, you have Liguria, Ligurians. Now, this is the map, more or less, that you should have in mind, because migration began, actually, from here, from Sitya here, Sityans, all the way, we're going straight like this, and like this. Some of them came straight to go. Perhaps next map will show you. Yes, here it is. So, what interests me here is primarily are the names. The different names, the different spellings that I'm going to prove to you in a moment, that different names are qualifying or designing the designating the same people. The Celtic people today have their origin in this what we call Sumerians or Scythians people. But be careful, not every Scythian, not every Celtic, you know, is, let's say, of the same tribe. Now let me explain this in a moment. You might be in a country, you might be part of the country, but you might not be of the same race. So as the migration began, Sumerians or Scythians, they gradually got mixed up or intermarried and so forth and so forth, but yet they kept their ethnical group, mixed with other groups, of course. But this is historical evidence shows how Sumerians, which are the ancestors of the Celts, or the Gauls, finally end up by Britannia and by Gallia, as you can see. Now here is one of Mr. McNair's, I guess, slide. I find it very interesting for two reasons. Look first of all where Scythia is again, most of Russia. As you remember, they started from the Black Sea and from Caspian Sea, then they came to Gallic or Celts. But let me just point out one thing which is to me most interesting here. Big Cymru. Now this is not biblical. This is history. The name Big Cymru means the house of Omri. Interesting, isn't it? Omri is the Bible. The name Big Cymru is the name by which Israelites were known to the Assyrians. Now this is the most interesting and important clue. In this, following the migration, you can see where the Big Cymru was, which I repeat is the Assyrian name given to the Israelites. And immediately after Assyrian Empire fell by 609 BC, a new nomadic nation appeared suddenly. Greek historians record these migrations and they describe this Big Cymru people, they described as people who escaped from the Assyrians. Interesting statements. The Greeks called these people by various names. They called them Cymri, they called them Cymeroi or Cymri, from which we have the word Cymri or Cymerians. But always remember Big Cymru because which means house of Omri. These names, of course, may sound Greek to you, they are Greek, actually. Most of them are. Nevertheless, it's historical evidence. A new population spread in Gaul. It did not arrive in mass. That's an interesting statement. History. In the course of a series of invasions, the two principal ones took place at the beginning and at the end of the same period, about 760 BC. Invaders called themselves Cimmerians or Cimmerians, when the Romans took the term Cymri to designate Cimmerians. I want you to see the words. They are different spellings. They're all yet describing the same people. Whether it's Cimmerians or Cymri or Cimmerians, or Big Cymru, or House of Omri. Now this is what I want you to understand, it's also important. Before the captivity, around 900 BC, let's say, Israel was very prosperous, powerful, among neighboring nations. Under the dynasty of Omri, the capital was moved to Samaria, or Samaria. Omri's reputation was great among neighboring people. It has been found on several historical documents, as you saw, the name Big Cymru. which actually means the house of Omri. And that's what the Assyrians called the Sumerians, or the, eventually you'll find out, the Celts. Now, let's go a bit further yet. If the 10 tribes had disappeared, says the Jewish encyclopedia, then the little accomplishment of divine prophecy would be impossible. If they had not disappeared, then they must actually exist under different names. That's exactly what happened. Now this again, you see, I wanted to compare the Bible statements with what history claims. Why? Let's go a bit further. The earliest writer who makes mention of the Kimri was Philemon. According to him, or the Aristotle, look, they called their ocean, the sea they came from, Mori Marusa, or Dead Sea, up to the promontory of Rubia and so forth. All right. Now this is a very famous historian in France. Look at this. People who call themselves Kimri or Bit Kimri, they are said to have come from Dead Sea, and they were called Kimris. This history, you can see the connection between history now and the Bible, something which historians, these are all French historians, they have it, but they never associate the Dead Sea. How many Dead Seas do we have in this world? Anyway. So, let's continue. Let me explain briefly the meaning of names. This could be an interesting study. I won't have time to enter into it, but sometime it will be interesting to know what names mean, actually. You see, at the time of Shakespeare, the King James had a different, shall I say, expression or expressions from modern English. Words change. At the time of Shakespeare, when something was artificial, it was something beautiful, it was full of art. Today, artificial is the exact opposite. Something awful was full of awe, it's great. Today, awful is something despicable, and so forth. So words change. Now, the same thing applies with the proper nouns. You see, when today I say Kimri, or Sumerians, or Celts, those are various names given by various nations, various people. But they designate the same people. Today, when I say Germany, to you, Germany makes sense. If you go to France, Germany is not known by the French people unless they know some English. They know the Germans under the name of Allemagne. Well, how do you associate Allemagne and Germany? Assyrians call them, as you know, the Bible calls them Assyrians. Here we have Assyrians, we have Germany, we have Allemagne. They designate all the same people. A Greek name was given, therefore, to certain people, and later on a Latin name was given. That's the reason why we have so many different names given one after the other. Now look at this one. The Gauls gave themselves the name Kimri. Well, how do you associate Gauls and Kimri? But again, where does Kimri stem from? It came from the house of Omri. This is not just coincidence. History speaks of Celts, Sumerians, and Gauls. Actually, these were the same people as a whole, known under different names. Remember, they continued their migration, as they remember the map I showed you. They left, as they migrated, some of them were left behind, some of them got married with other tribes and so forth. Therefore, they had this amalgamation. I know they have been tribes changing, but nevertheless, most of the time they got their names from where they started, and sometimes they left their names as a geographical location. I want to stress this a moment because this is often important. There's a question of being called by geographical name, by racial name, by tribal name, or perhaps by name called because someone else called you that way. Hence we have a mixture of people as they migrated. There were intermarriages, some died, some were born, and so forth and so forth, but yet, as a whole, we're talking about not individuals, but as tribes. It appears that the Celts, Again, look at this. Giving themselves the name Waller or Dollar. Now, where did they take or get those names? This indicated that they had been chased from the ancient home. They had voluntarily condemned themselves to exile. Look at the statement. This history. You find two great statements here. That first of all, they were exiled. Yes, they were. Israelites were. And they were actually chased from, which was true also. They were chased away from their own country. So you see, they bring with them some of their background or some of their history with them. I want to stress a major fact again here. A name does not necessarily indicate the ethnical origin. A name can be geographic or geographical. For instance, take the example of the USA. Who is an American? Early fathers, yes, they were Americans, but they had 13 colonies. They weren't all English. They were all from different parts of Northwestern Europe. Today we have a diversified group of Americans. We have the white, we have the black, we have the yellow, we have the Indians. They are Americans. But you see, we are known as an American group, but not as the same ethnical group. And this is something you have to remember, because this applies also to history of Celts. As a whole, there were Celts, but there were in the groups, other nations, other groups, other tribes. And that's where history actually just goes off tangent, and they start making statements which are not right. Oftentimes, when you really study, especially if you study etymology, it's a fascinating subject, especially with languages, because you will find out names that will never, never seem alike or sound alike. Now here's a case. Weller or Goller or Galli, the Germanic language, means stranger, wanderer. Do you know that the title stranger or wanderer was given to the site of Scythians and the Celtic people, and the Celtic or Celtic means the stranger and wanderer? These are all the same words from different, perhaps, languages, the Latin or Greek or whatever it might be. You see, they are designing the same people again. The wanderers, the strangers, and Gallic, and so forth and so forth. The letter W or the G in English are interchangeable, like Wales and Gauls. That's a totally different subject. But it is interesting because we oftentimes, in history, let's say, look at names, and when we try to raise the names as to where they come from, rather than to study the etymological foundation, and also primarily with the biblical indication. I repeat, not all people bearing the same name are of the same ethnical origin. This is true with the Gauls, with the Celts, with the Sumerians, which are primarily the same group, but combined with other group of people. Later, the Scythians. Now, not all Scythians, not all Celts are Israelites. Bear this in mind. Well, I'm talking as a whole, not as individuals. These are German forms of Well, or Vala, Welsh, Valakis, Wellen, Galois, Gaul. All the same words. Because some of those are English words, Welsh and Gauls. The W and the G, I repeat, are interchangeable in etymology. Actually, what is fascinating case, oftentimes you'll find out that the old languages, not the Hebrew, I speak about the pagan, perhaps backward countries, they only have 6 or 7 consonants. Today, there are some countries in Africa, they only have 6 or 7 consonants. If you say B, they don't hear B. B, P, D, it's all the same sound. They can't hear. That's the reason why sometimes, even in the old times, W's and the G's have the same sounds at the time. But that's a different subject. Let's continue. Names, as I mentioned a moment ago, can be different from country to country. But they designate the same people, not necessarily the same race. Now, according to Encyclopedia Britannica, most historical works on migrations of the Sumerians locate them originally from Scythia. In other words, from the Black Sea. Here's a statement from Britannica that the Scythians or the Sumerians came from the Black Sea. From there were driven far from this country by a group of invaders called Scythians by 700 BC. And let me show you something to me the most fascinating. I'm sure you have heard of King Darius. This is a stone honoring King Darius, his conquest. This is original stone writing, of course in our own letters. Three different languages, in Persian, in Susa, which is Elam, or part of Persia, and in Babylonian. Could you really find any similarity between Scythia in Persian, Scythia in Susa, and the country of Sumerians? Yet, in this Eastern stone, the three languages meant the same thing, Persian, Susa, and Babylonian. Scythia, therefore, are the same people as the Sumerians. And do you know how they pronounce Scythia? Here's the phonetic, Saka. In Susa, phonetics of Scythia was Saka. In Babylonian, phonetics of Saka, or whatever it is, was Gimri or Jimri. You see, when you look at this, I can't find any more convincing document to prove that Scythians, as a whole, not individually, as a whole, and the Saka, of whom Mr. Armstrong speaks in his writings, and the Gauls, and the Sumerians, and the Gimri, they are the same people called by different names and changing names as geographically they change places. But you see, this, as I mentioned a moment ago, identifies the Scythians and the Sumerians. 100 years later, Darius the First, that's the way he identified the Sumerians, with Saka, as the same people. The Scythians were composed of a mixture of peoples, and one of these groups of people were Saka, which later separated themselves and settled in Western Europe. So the term Scythia, as well as Kimri, they all designate the same tribes. And the final destination of the Cimbri, or the Sumerians, is well established by historians. Cimbri migrated to the west of Europe and settled in Wales, gradually in France. Today, therefore, Cimbri, or Cimmerians, or the Celts, or the Gauls, are the descendants or the ancestors of the French-speaking people. This is something very important to remember. Language does not necessarily indicate race. Let's now talk about another people who invaded the country. Let me just go back to rehearse. First we found Ligurians and Iberians. They were not the French ancestors. Then we have Gauls moving in. The Gauls under the names of Sumerians and so forth, that's what we saw. But then there was another people, another group who moved in. Now, once again, I wanted to get to the point because that's where the crucial point is at. Remember, first, what we call France was inhabited by two Gentile people, Iberians and Ligurians. Then the Celts or the Celts moved in under the name of Gauls, or Sumerians, or Scythians, at last part of them. To forget your language, that's what happened during the captivity, when actually those who were taken captive, they forgot their native tongues. Furthermore, as they went from place to place, they picked up words and expressions. That too is part of etymology, it's a different subject, but you see, I can show you today there are so many German words in the French language, perhaps 5,000 German words in the French language. How do you explain this? France never was part of Germany. No, but they migrated to the Assyrians. They were with the Assyrians. Therefore, they picked up quite a few words, and they left, of course, quite a few words. But anyway, the people who moved in later on were called as Franks, and they gave their name to the country. Now, here again, I wish I'd, you know, known as to how long this would be, because of the fact each tribe is an interesting facet. Franks actually are known to be Gentile people. I ask you a question. If all of the Franks were Gentiles, then how come that Charlemagne, who was the king of the Franks, the Frankish tribe, became the ancestor, let's say, of Queen Elizabeth today? Is she a Jew or Jewish descent? Is she German? Did God say that the Germans are going to be occupying the scepter or the Judah? I just ask you the question. Now, let's go back to the Franks. Franks were actually Germanic people. I agree. But you see, Franks had two tribes, very well known historically speaking. One was Rhinish, which came from the word Rhine, the river Rhine. That's Germanic. And the other one was Celian Franks. Remember this. Rhinish Franks and Celian Franks. Rhinish Franks were the tribes, Germanic tribes. The Celian Franks were not Germanic. You know what Celian means? S-A-L-I-A-N, Celian. The word Celian comes from salt. Celian Franks, as they named themselves, they came from the salt sea. Again, I ask you, how many salt seas do we have? They are, history recognizes them as being part of the people who came from the salt sea. France became quite justifiably by the name of the country in which they were only imperceptible minority of France. You see, what they did, they occupied, of course, the major part of France. They left their name there, but France is not, shall I say, the ancestors of France. Or the ancestors were not, Franks were not. The fact remains that Franks invaded France, where the Gauls were, they left their name, but, I repeat, the tribes that invaded France, there were two tribes, Germanic, Rhinish, and also Celian. But look what the French historian says, that the German tribes, or the, for that matter, for any Franks, they hardly left any mark in France. That's history. And then again, another statement, the Germanic peoples brought of themselves nothing useful to Gaul, other than a little young blood. That's history again. All right? And how come, as I said, that they actually were so important that they left their name over there? You see, France is called after the Franks, and not after the Gauls, because of the fact the Franks occupied what we call the heart of France. If you know anything about France today, and has been like this for a century, Paris is the center of France. The French people today in France are about 54 million. One-fifth of all the French people live in Paris or in suburbs of Paris. All the railroads go to Paris. If you want to go from Bordeaux, let's say, to Lyon, you're better off to go to Paris, all the way north, and come down again. It's much faster. Otherwise, you would have lots of zigzags. Therefore, you see, once you conquer Paris, you have conquered France. This has been, shall I say, the Achilles heel for France. Germans know it. That's the reason why every time there's a war, the first thing Germany does takes invades Paris. And France falls. So this has been the secret, perhaps, of the Franks. The Franks conquered what we call l'Île de France at the time. So they took it, they left their name. But I repeat, please understand, this is also important now, because of the fact that the whole difference is, the Franks themselves did not leave much mark on France, except the Celian Franks, which left, as you will see in a moment, the dynasty of kings and so forth. The two most important and powerful of the Frankish tribes, I repeat, were the Celian Franks and the Rhenish Franks. I repeat again, the Celian Franks were of Israelitish descent. They were composed primarily of Judah. And the Celian, if you check the Britannica, it will say the Celian Franks came from the Salt Sea. The Celian Franks actually established a dynasty. I won't have time to enter into details here, you know very well, that the royal families of Europe and of Great Britain came from the Celian Franks. The Frankish dynasties must then be the descendants of Judah. If there was nothing of Judah here, I'm not saying all of them were, but if there was nothing, then how could this man here be the carrier of the scepter? Yet we know God has promised that David shall never lack a successor. Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 17, as you know. So the house of Israel never lacked a king on the throne of David. And that throne of David was continued today to this moment to the Queen Elizabeth by this man over here, Charlemagne, who was a Frank. But Charlemagne was a Celian Frank and not a Rhenish Frank. Here you see the coronation of Charlemagne. And as you know, the Queen Elizabeth is descendant of that throne. Now let's briefly examine some of the customs of Gauls. I want to just pause you for a couple of seconds because I want to go back. It's difficult, I know, for you to realize because there are so many strange names. But remember, there were Ligurians and Iberians. They did not leave any marks in France. They left. Then the Gauls moved in. The Gauls moved in under the names of Celts, Cimmerians, Scythians, which partly were geographical names, partly ethnical, but as a whole, they were the Gauls, Israelites. Then you have this new minority, let's say, tribe moving in, Franks, primarily Celians. They left their name. And now today we have, therefore, the country, France, is an Israelite country. Southern part is still somewhat affected by the Ligurians, but very little. But if you study the French history, the French background, the French, shall I say, traits of character, you'll be surprised what you can find of similarities between Israelites and Gauls or Celts or Sumerians. Now, it will be interesting to see what the Bible says in one hand, what they should do, what they should not do, and what the people did. Oftentimes, as you know, Bible, when the Bible says, don't do it, people will do it, and vice versa. Now, here we have interesting statement. In Leviticus chapter 26, God said, you should make for yourselves no idols, erect no graven image or pillar. You shall not set up a figured stone in your land to bow down to them, for I am the Lord. This was given to Israel. But Israel, as they left captivity, they became pagans. After 100 years or so with the Assyrian Empire, they were totally pagan. Therefore, they might have had this in their minds, but they did not obey. Of course, they didn't obey before anyway. On the right side, there's another prophecy in Jeremiah. And God says, set up waymarks for yourself. Make yourself guideposts. Consider well the highway, the road by which you went. Return over to Israel. Now, they kept part of that, they kept part of this. When you go back and study the life of Celts and Sumerians and Scythians, you will find these two commandments distorted, perverted, sometimes kept, sometimes not kept. Partly obeyed and partly disobeyed. That is interesting. Because of the fact, I want you to talk for a few moments about the Druids. The Druids were the priests of the Gauls. Now, Druids are not Levites, please, don't understand. I'm only showing a Gentile, what the world calls Gentile priesthood, what the world calls. But that means that the Druids were just priests of this tribe which came out of Scythians and so forth. They were pagans, but But they had some customs. They had some traditions that no other pagan priesthood has ever given in history. Never. And this is, to me, most interesting. Historians are astonished to find no temples among the Druids. The Druids are pagans. But somehow they've kept this thing over here. There is no temple in the Druidistic, let's say, priesthood. Contrary to other nations who often build temples in which to practice their cult, the Celts built none of these. The religion of the Druids prohibited construction of temples and images figured as gods. Now, all other priesthood, they had images and everything, but somehow Druids never had it. They would not build any images of things of God. This point is very interesting, because this Israel is the only nation which was given by God the commandment saying you should not make a graven image. The Druids practiced their cult in open air, often under oak trees. Interesting. I'm saying they're pagans, but they have kept some of the traditions that you will not find anywhere else. And they carefully placed pillars, such as cromlechs or dolmens. I'll show them in a moment to you in some of those, because it's fascinating. The huge stones, there are 6,800 of them in France. 6,800. And also them cromlechs and so forth. But I repeat, Israel had become pagan, had actually tried to follow the pagan countries, the pagan nations. But they were cut off from God. They had perverted God's teaching, but somehow they kept some strange customs that no other pagan countries or nations had. They left marks behind them. Now these marks, at times, they became places of idols or worship, I know. But as a whole, at least the Druidic priesthood, they were not supposed to use those things as a temple and so forth. Now this is again another map of Mr. McNair. I want to show you here that the only portion I'm interested in right is the red section here. The red section is where you find what we call the dolmens or the other type of monuments, like cromlechs and menhirs and so forth. But why is it that it's only this part of it? Later, of course, they went down to Spain, probably because some of the Israelites moved down to Spain with the Iberians. That's very, very possible. But look where all these stones are found, and not other parts of Europe. The Druids were priests in Gaul. They had strange customs, as I said, compared to other pagan nations. Some of the customs, I should say, they're could be compared to what the Bible says, what God told Israelites. I repeat, please understand, I'm not saying the Druids were Levites, but I'm saying that they took with them some of the Levitical priests' teachings with them, and brought about with them because of the fact you would be surprised with similarities. Now, for instance, the Druids were exempt from military service. They would not be part of military. Moreover, historians say that the Druids did never pay taxes. As you know, in the Bible, Numbers chapter, I guess, and so on and so forth. No, it doesn't matter, I will come to it in a moment. In the Bible, when God numbered the tribes, he never numbered the Levites as part of the army. Well, coincidence, maybe, a strange coincidence, and also interesting coincidence, because of the fact some of the leftover perhaps teachings, they might still remember with them. The cult of sacred stones constitutes one of the most ancient forms of religion. It was widespread among the Semites or Semites. Now, if you want to know what Stonehenge in England is, look at this. It's very famous, circle of raised stones, we call it Stonehenge, in Great Britain, is perhaps the best known example of this outdoor temple. Now, we think it's an outdoor temple, maybe it is, I don't know. But this is the most astronomical calendar. Any historian would say it's very precise. It is able to, capable of predicting the seasons of the year, even the eclipses of the moon and the sun. So that's all we know about it. It's fascinating that this was actually built by the Celts, or the Welts, or the Sumerians, Gauls, call it what you want, who actually were the ancestors or the descendants of the tribes of Israel. Here we have another one in France, Carnac. This is a village in western France. You won't find it in Germany. It's a western France village near the Atlantic coast. It is the site of more than 3,000 prehistoric stones like this. 3,000 of them. Strange. Is it what we saw? The Bible says you have to leave marks behind you. I don't know. I'm just giving it an interesting, perhaps, highlight here. The druids, as I mentioned a moment ago, were known to worship under oak trees. Why oak trees? What are peach trees? I don't know. But you see, here again, in the Bible says, they set for themselves pillars and so forth, and on every high hill and under every green tree, every oak tree. See, it shows something that came with them. Later on again, you might perhaps compare this with oak tree that was very well liked by the druids. Historians could not explain and cannot explain why druids really liked oak trees so much. They don't know. There's no way of explaining. And they claim that oak trees played a major part in the druidic culture. The Bible said, you know, in Genesis chapter 25, so they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods, rings that were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak tree, which was near Shechem or Shechem. Just again, coincidence could be, I don't know, similarities. But I think it, to me, interesting enough. And there are many examples in the Bible, actually, when we speak of oak tree and cults and so forth. As you can see, even though they are totally paganized, they've kept some strange customs. But now there's more. There's much more yet as far as their customs and traditions. When you study the history of nations, you will find certain similarities between pagan nations. But you will not find among pagan nations some principles which are underlined in the Bible. Now, very well-known statement, everyone knows this one. We begin, God begins the by the day from evening to evening. That's the way it goes for the Sabbath. Fine. Why is it that among all the pagan people that we will find the goal to count the days by the number of nights? Interesting. Coincidence? No, I don't think so. See, again, you will find the people there who have kept something with them. Moreover, if you want to go a bit further, the druids were priests who instructed the people. The druids were the only priesthood, pagan priesthood, who believed in one God, that monotheism. As you know, people believe in many gods. This is the people who believe in one God only, even though it was perverted, but one God. Their religion forbade them to make images of God. Remember, they did not do any military service. Here again, the Bible shows that with Israel, the tribe of Levi, the priesthood, let's say, were not counted when they counted, let's say, the people for the military. So, as you can see, there are quite a few interesting aspects of the druidic priesthood, and the Gauls and the Celts. Of course, when I speak of druids, I speak of the Celts because they're the same tribes. They are just one is the priesthood, the other is just the people there. But the Druids also had something else yet. They had another part to play, and especially they played this part in the, as they were the public or private arbiters. In other words, they were the judges. They passed as the most just men and were the arbiters of public and private disputes. Especially pertaining to them was the judgment of crimes and murders. Again, interesting. No other priesthood with pagan nations had this type of a position or post. Reminds you of something? As you can see, Israel, even though it was cut off, even though they were paganized, they kept some customs that are unheard of with other nations. Yet I repeat again, please understand, they were full of paganism. They believed in immortality, which is another strange aspect of it. I don't know why they got this idea, but yet, you know, look at this. They proclaimed immortality of the soul. Nevertheless, they believed a day of fire and water would prevail over all the rest of the world. Now, where do you get this? You won't find this in any other history. They believe in immortality of the soul, which is a perversion, of course, of paganism, yet they believe a day of fire and the water. Again, notice the perhaps strange resemblance. Yeah, I don't think it should surprise us too much, because even today the Jews, believe it or not, some of the Jews, we know, believe in immortality of the soul. I was horrified, Dr. Hay will tell you this, when I went to about Mr. Carlson's wife's funeral a few months ago in Beverly Hills, and it was a Jewish ceremony. And they openly stated that, you know, that they believe in immortality of the soul. Here's a Jewish tribe, Jews today. So why should we be surprised that even a few hundred years back or a few thousand years back, the Druidic priesthood or the Celts also had turned away from God and perverted, let's say, their religion. Now here we come back. So this map again, I wanted you to see it. There's your Caspian Sea, Beit Qumri. As you remember the migration where we started, all the way from here, and this is the way it went, and all these various dolmens and so forth, and Stonehenge over here, and finally settlements over here. And this is historical, of course, history proves it. Scythia, and don't forget that all the time, all the while, the Cimmerians, as they moved to Scythia, they took their names, they left their names and so forth. So gradually, you have a people who came out of Beit Qumri, the house of Omri, all the way to Scythia, and northern part of Europe, and eventually the Celts and so forth, who are the ancestors, as Mr. Armstrong has so clearly specified in his own book. And I would like in closing to at least show a statement from Josephus. This is written just about Christ's time, more or less. The 10 tribes, forming an immense multitude, are located, as we say, beyond the river. Yes, beyond, far away. Now, again, this is history. As you can see, I could only give you highlights. I could not do much, but I have about 200 pages. Documentation, which I did, of course, somewhere. You have a summary here, and I tried to make it as simple as I possibly could. But as I mentioned, out of the 20 or 40 or 50,000 booklets I've sent of this subject in French to the French people, perhaps not even 5 have even objected to the historical accuracy of it. Of course, they might not believe in the Bible, but nevertheless, they could not find anything wrong. I was just told that to give at least a couple of words, which I will, about the French work, but I hope that some other time I could talk about the French work, because it's not a subject. But it will just tie in. You saw what France today was able to do. How France today occupies a major place in history. So in God's work, we also have
major work. Here's a side of French-speaking countries in the world today, in yellow. Lots of Americans don't even realize that even Vietnam originally speaks French-speaking. Madagascar, all of Africa, most of Northern Africa, France, Belgium, Switzerland. And you have Guyana, the West Indies, and of course you have Canada. So there's your God's work today the way it is. We have 16 churches, French-speaking, on the three continents. As I said, I don't want to stress on the point. It's not my purpose to talk to today, but I wanted to show that even though we, today, the French-speaking countries, we primarily cover France, the French-speaking countries and the French-speaking people do come primarily from the same Israelitish tribe. As far as the work is concerned today, as I mentioned, perhaps I could sometimes talk about it, I won't spend time. We have all of the major booklets, of course. We have PT. The first PT was in 1963. At the height, we had 120,000 copies of the PT. Now we're down to about 50,000. But believe it or not, today the French PT goes to 103 countries. We have all of the major booklets. Not just all showing them, they're one after the other. But all of these books go to all the countries you saw, and certainly, to me, one of the most interesting and fascinating books, which I hope to be able to, you know, send more and more and more, would be this one over here, The Wonderful World Tomorrow. There's the world which we are expecting and hoping. It will be a world where there won't be any confusion. And by the time this world comes, I'm sure we all will know that the Celts and the Gauls and the Sumerians and Israel, we all came from the same origin. And it's wonderful to know that today we have been able to be given this type of a truth. In closing, I would like to say thank you to all of you. Thank you especially for the people upstairs who helped me tremendously. Larry Lamasta, and also Mr. John Hofford and Stephanie Saracina and all the crew. But I also would like to say thank you very much to someone who has made it possible for all of us to be able to understand, to be able to know, to be able to realize that without this man's help, you would have never known what you know, I would have never known what I know. And I'm glad God had called him to open his mind, and through him we have been able to understand. Thank you very much.